mother. Apparently, he had not yet found a place. He began by complaining that he had no letter from his mother, then confessed, "What language can express the anxiety I feel to be with you when I sit down to write? But as it is now a thing impossible, I shall quit the subject and say nothing more about it." He was glad to report that all the Lewises and Merriweathers in Albemarle were in good health. He passed on a rumor that Cousin Thomas Merriweather is married, and asked if she knew anything about it. He concluded, "I live in hopes of receiving a letter from you by which, as the only means, I may be informed of your health and welfare. I enjoy my health at present, which I hope is your situation. I am your ever-loving son." Merriweather's next surviving letter to his mother, undated, written from Cloverfields, related family news and the complications he was encountering in trying to get into school. His brother-in-law, Edmund Anderson, who had married his older sister Jane in 1785 when she was 15, was preparing to go into business in Richmond and would have been there before this had not the smallpox broke out in that city, which rages with great violence, and until this disorder can be extirpated, they will continue where they are, i.e. in Hanover. Sister Jane and children are well. The children have grown very much, but I see no appearance of another. Parson Matthew Maury, son of one of Thomas Jefferson's teachers, was the man Merriweather wanted to study with, but so far he had not been able to get started. "I hope Reuben, his younger brother, still in Georgia, is at school, though I am not yet engaged in that pursuit myself," he wrote. Robert Lewis and myself applied to Mr. Maury soon after my return to Albemarle, who informed us that he could not take us by any means till next spring, and as what we would wish to learn would interfere so much with his Latin business, that he had rather not take us at all. Merriweather had therefore applied to Reverend James Waddell, but success was uncertain. "If we do not go to Mr. Waddell, we shall certainly go to one Mr. Williamson, a young Scotchman who teaches in about 10 miles of this place, and who was earnestly recommended both by Mr. Maury and Waddell. In this situation, I have now been waiting for this 3 weeks past." In the fall of 1787, Reuben came to Cloverfields for a visit. As he was leaving, he asked Merriweather to come to Georgia the following fall. On March 7, 1788, Merriweather wrote Reuben to say he could not make the visit. "By reason of my being at school. I set in with Parson Maury soon after you left me, with whom I continued till Christmas, and then I fully expected to have stayed 6 months longer at least, if not another year. But Cousin William D. Merriweather then said he did not think it worthwhile, as I had got well acquainted with the English grammar, and might learn the geography at home. Upon this, I concluded to stay at Uncle Peachy Gilmer's and to go to school to a master in the neighborhood in order to get acquainted with figures, where I am now stationed." He hated not being able to visit Georgia. "I should like very much to have some of your sport fishing and hunting," he told Reuben. But he was determined to improve himself and said he must be doing something that will no doubt be more to my advantage hereafter, that is, getting an education. In June 1788, Merriweather's guardian paid £7 for room, board, and tuition. In January 1789, he paid £13, and in July, another £2. That summer, Merriweather was able to go to Georgia for a visit. In the fall, he studied under Dr. Charles Everett. His schoolmate and cousin Peachy Gilmer, 5 years younger than Merriweather, hated Dr. Everett. According to Gilmer, he was afflicted with very bad health, of an atrabilious and melancholy temperament, peevish, capricious, and every way disagreeable. He invented cruel punishments for the scholars. His method of teaching was as bad as anything could be. He was impatient of interruption. We seldom applied for assistance, said our lessons badly, made no proficiency, and acquired negligent and bad habits. Young Gilmer described Merriweather as always remarkable for perseverance, which in the early period of his life seemed nothing more than obstinacy in pursuing the trifles that employ that age. A martial temper, great steadiness of purpose, self-possession, and undaunted courage. His person was stiff and without grace, bow-legged, awkward, formal, and almost without flexibility. His face was comely and by many considered handsome. Meriwether loved to ramble, as Jefferson put it, into the mountains or to visit Jane and other relatives, or down to Georgia, a trip he made at least once on his own. Later in his life, he met his mother's half-joking complaints about his roving propensities with a laughing response that he had inherited this disposition from her. Albemarle County records show that Meriwether's guardian was meticulous. His accounts include the purchase of 1 pair knee buckles, 10 vest buttons, 2 hanks silk, 1 pin niff. There are numerous entries for pocket money. One arresting entry is for 1 quart whiskey for Negro wench. Another covers 1 quart rum and 1 pound sugar. Meriwether transferred in 1790 to Reverend James Waddell, who was a great contrast to the ill-tempered Everett. Meriwether called Waddell a very polite scholar. He wrote his mother in August, "I expect to continue here for 18 months or 2 years. Every civility is here paid to me and leaves me without any reason to regret the loss of a home of nearer connection. As soon as I complete my education, you shall certainly see me." In October 1791, he wrote his mother to report that he had received a letter from Uncle Thomas Gilmer, Peachy's father, "which gives most agreeable information of your welfare and my brother's assiduity and attention at school." He said he had just returned from a visit with his sister Jane, who had shown him a letter their mother had written that summer. From it, he learned that Captain Marks had died, leaving his mother once again a widow, with Reuben plus the 2 younger children to care for. Mrs. Marks wanted Meriwether to come to Georgia to organize a move back to Virginia for her and her dependents. "I will, with a great deal of cheerfulness, do it," Meriwether wrote his mother, "but it will be out of my power sooner than 18 months or 2 years." He promised her she would always have a home at Locust Hill, and, "You may rely on my fidelity to render your situation as comfortable as it is in my power." In April 1792, Meriwether wrote his mother that he had learned from her letters to Jane that she was anxious to return to Virginia that spring. "This, together with my sister's impatience to see you, has induced me to quit school and prepare for setting out immediately." He had employed an artisan at Monticello to make a carriage for the trip. It would be ready by May 1st. Meriwether needed to purchase horses and collect some money. "If I cannot collect a sufficiency from the lands that are now due, I shall dispose of my tobacco for cash in order to be detained as little time as possible. I shall set out about the 15th of May." He did as promised, and by fall he had gone to Georgia, organized the move of his mother and her children and the slaves, animals, and equipment, and brought the whole back to Virginia, where he set up at Locust Hill and began his life as a planter and head of household. Thus ended Meriwether Lewis's scholarly career. What had he learned? Not enough Latin to use the language in his extensive later writings, nor any other foreign language. Not enough orthography ever to be comfortable or proficient with the spelling of English words. But then he lived in an age of freedom of spelling, a time when even so well-read and learned a man as Jefferson had trouble maintaining consistency in his spelling. He did develop a strong, sprightly, and flowing writing style. What he read can only be inferred from references in his writings, which indicate he read a little ancient history, some Milton and Shakespeare, and a smattering of recent British history. He was an avid reader of journals of exploration, especially those about the adventures of Captain James Cook. He got his figures down pretty well, along with a solid base in botany and natural history. He picked up all he could about geography. He had achieved the educational level of the well-rounded Virginian, who was somewhat familiar with the classics, reasonably current with philosophy. Only in the field of plantation affairs was he expected to be a specialist, and to that end Lewis now set out. He may have done so with some regret, for he valued education highly. All his life he kept after Reuben and his half-brother John Marks and half-sister Mary Marks to make every effort and meet every expense to further their educations. The last paragraph of his March 31, 1805 letter to his mother, written from Fort Mandan, far up the Missouri River, reads, I must request of you, before I conclude this letter, to send John Marks to the college at Williamsburg, as soon as it shall be thought that his education has been sufficiently advanced to fit him for that seminary. For you may rest assured that as you regard his future prosperity, you had better make any sacrifice of his property than suffer his education to be neglected or remain incomplete. Perhaps as an 18-year-old he wished to continue his education, to attend the seminary at William and Mary, but it could not be. He was responsible for his mother, his brother, John and Mary Marks, the slaves at Locust Hill, his inheritance. Instead of book learning at William and Mary, he was destined to learn from the school of the plantation. At age 18, he was the head of a small community of about 24 slaves and nearly 2,000 acres of land. His lessons from now on would be in management, in soils, crops, distillery, carpentry, blacksmithing, shoemaking, weaving, coopering, timbering, in killing, dressing, and skinning cattle and sheep, preserving vegetables and meats, repairing plows, harrows, saws, and rifles, caring for horses and dogs, treating the sick, and the myriad of other tasks that went into running a plantation. At 18 years, he was on his own. He had traveled extensively across the southern part of the United States. He had shown himself to be a self-reliant, self-contained, self-confident teenager, and was a young man who took great pride in his perseverance and steadiness of purpose, as Peachy Gilmer had put it. His health was excellent, his physical powers were outstanding, he was sensitive and caring about his mother and his family. He was started. Chapter 2. Planter, 1792-1794. Foaled, not born, Virginia planters were said to be. They would go 5 miles to catch a horse in order to ride 1 mile afterward. In a country of vast estates, without cities or public transportation of any kind, with plantation seats far apart, riding was not a matter of sport or diversion, but of necessity. Planters spent much, if not most, of every working day on the back of a horse. Good horsemanship was taken for granted among the gentry. They had to be experts in the judging, feeding, breeding, and care of horses. From the time he was able to sit astride a horse, Meriwether Lewis was a fine, fearless rider. He became an excellent judge of horses and an expert in their care. Jefferson, believing that the taming of the horse had resulted in the degeneracy of the human body, urged the young to walk for exercise. Lewis took his advice and became a great hiker, with feet as tough as his butt. As a boy and young man, he went barefoot, in the Virginia manner. Jefferson's grandson claimed not to have worn shoes until he was 10. According to Jefferson, the young Lewis hunted barefoot in the snow. Like riding and hiking, dancing was taken for granted. Indeed, dancing was little short of a social necessity. "Virginians are of genuine blood," said one traveler. "They will dance or die." Like Jefferson, Lewis learned to dance the minuet, reels, and country dances at Reverend Maury's school. One diarist wrote in the year of Lewis's birth, "Any young gentleman traveling through the colony is presumed to be acquainted with dancing, boxing, playing the fiddle, and small sword, and cards." There is no evidence that Lewis learned to fiddle, but he knew the rest of the list. By no means were all Virginia planters or their sons paragons of virtue. If there was high-minded and learned political talk around the table, and much idealism and protestation of devotion to the common good, there also were temptations often too strong for healthy, wealthy young men to resist. Jefferson's father died when he was a boy. Decades later, in a letter to his grandson, Jefferson wrote in a famous passage, "When I recollect that at 14 years of age the whole care and direction of myself was thrown on myself entirely, without a relative or friend qualified to advise or guide me, and recollect the various sorts of bad company with which I associated from time to time, I am astonished I did not turn off with some of them, and become as worthless to society as they were. From the circumstances of my position, I was often thrown into the society of horse racers, card players, fox hunters, scientific and professional men, and of dignified men. And many a time I asked myself, in the enthusiastic moment of the death of a fox, the victory of a favorite horse, the issue of a question eloquently argued at the bar, or in the great council of the nation, well, which of these kinds of reputation should I prefer? That of a horse jockey? A fox hunter? An orator? Or the honest advocate of my country's rights? Quite possibly, Jefferson talked to Lewis in the same Polonius-like style in which he wrote his grandson. Certainly, Lewis had thoughts similar to those expressed by Jefferson. On his 31st birthday, Lewis wrote in a famous passage, "This day I completed my 31st year. I reflected that I had as yet done but little, very little indeed, to further the happiness of the human race, or to advance the information of the succeeding generation. I viewed with regret the many hours I have spent in indolence, and now sorely feel the want of that information which those hours would have given me had they been judiciously expended." He resolved, "In future, to live for mankind, as I have heretofore lived for myself." Such high-blown, idealized language, and the sentiments it reflected, along with that heartfelt resolve to do better, was characteristic of the Virginia gentry. It was almost a convention, a part of the social standard, like good manners. A Virginia gentleman was expected to be hospitable and generous, courteous in his relations with his peers, chivalrous toward women, and kind to his inferiors. There was a high standard of politeness. Jefferson once remarked that politeness was artificial good humor, a valuable preservative of peace and tranquility. Wenching and other debauchery, heavy drinking and similar personal vices were common enough, but as long as they did not interfere with relations between members of the gentry, they were condoned. The unpardonable sins were lying and meanness of spirit. Along with his perseverance, all his life Lewis prided himself on his honesty. These qualities were important for his self-esteem. His word, written and spoken, was his bond. A less admirable part of the code of the Virginia gentleman was the drinking, which could be excessive. One English traveler just after the Revolution described his perception of the typical Albemarle planter. "He rises about 8 o'clock, drinks what he calls a julep, which is a large glass of rum sweetened with sugar, then walks, or more generally rides, round his plantation, views his stock, inspects his crops, and returns about 10 o'clock to breakfast on cold meat or ham, fried hominy, toast, and cider. About 12 or 1, he drinks a toddy to create him an appetite for dinner, which he sits down to at 2 o'clock. He commonly drinks toddy till bedtime. During all this time, he is neither drunk nor sober, but in a state of stupefaction. When he attends the courthouse or some horse race or cockfight, he gets so egregiously drunk that his wife sends a couple of Negroes to conduct him safe home." One may doubt that this planter was as typical as the Englishman asserted, but still regret that such men were among the contemporaries of the teenaged master of Locust Hill. Plantation management required attention to detail and sharp observation. In these areas, Lewis excelled. Jefferson described him as "an assiduous and attentive farmer, observing with minute attention all plants and insects he met with." Lewis did not plant or harvest with his own hands. No member of the Virginia gentry did. When Jefferson or Lewis or any other slave owner said he had planted such and so, or that he had built this fence or that building, he did not mean to imply that he had done it with his own hands. His slaves did the work. "It is the poor Negroes who alone work hard," one traveler commented, "and I am sorry to say, fair hard. Incredible is the fatigue which the poor wretches undergo, and it is wonderful that nature should be able to support it." Lewis was successful at adding land to his holdings, something also critical to a Virginia planter. He ran Locust Hill and, in addition, acquired an 800-acre tract on the Red River in Montgomery County, took title to 180 acres of land that had belonged to Captain Marks, and secured another parcel in Clark County. Such constant expansion was critical because the Virginia plantation of the day was incredibly wasteful. The low ground or inferior bottom land was planted to corn to provide food for slaves and animals. Fertile land, identified by hardwood growth, was saved for tobacco. The planters had their slaves gird large trees and leave the trees to die while plowing lightly around them. Slaves created hills for tobacco with a hoe without bothering to remove the trees. After three annual crops of tobacco, these fields grew wheat for a year or so before being abandoned and allowed to revert to pine forest. The planters let their stock roam wild, made no use of animal manure, and practiced only the most rudimentary crop rotation. Meanwhile, the planters moved their slaves to virgin lands and repeated the process. The system allowed the planters to use to the maximum the two things in which they were really rich, land and slaves. Tobacco, their only cash crop, was dependent on an all but unlimited quantity of each. The Virginians' lust for land and their resulting rage for speculation can only be marveled at. Before the Revolution, George Washington owned tens of thousands of acres in the Tidewater and Piedmont and over 63,000 acres of Trans-Appalachia. He wanted more. Jefferson inherited more than 5,000 acres in the Piedmont from his father. He wanted more. From his wife, he got another 11,000 acres. And though he was a substantial landowner, he was not a great one by Virginia standards. Tobacco wore out land so fast there could never be enough, but tobacco never brought in enough money to allow planters to get ahead. Their speculation in land was done on credit and promises and warrants, not cash, so they were always land rich and cash poor. Small wonder Jefferson was obsessed.